If you ever see a newborn baby, they're all wearing the same hat.
It's a monopoly.
It has to be. They're
It's a
all wearing the
white
same
cloth
hat.
hat. I think anyone could make
No,
that.
it's like tri-colored with stripes.
Oh,
They're all wearing the
so
same
it's, you
hat.
just proved it's not a monopoly because my kids got these like white colored
Yeah, but you
different
went to the
hats.
Deep Value Hospital.
This podcast contains the arguably witty banter of two friends, Skippy and Doogles, that like to debate about investing. The content is intended to be entertaining and for informational purposes only, not investment advice. You should do your own research and consult a financial professional before using any of the information in this podcast, and especially before investing.
You just got me thinking about Samuel Jackson and how he professes his deepest loves for you.
That is a tasty burger. No?
No. This is how I love. That's how he did it.
I don't know that one. Which movie
you want,
is
you
this?
Want my
is
love?
How I love.
Take my love. What
Which
about that
movie
one?
is this?
Negotiator. I think that's what it was called. Well, he said,
Oh,
you want my
he's like,
blood. You want my blood, take my blood. I'm just inserting love into it.
I've seen that movie. I quickly forgot about that movie. You should too, Doogles.
Fair
Samuel
enough.
L., isn't he in like more movies than anyone on Earth? His movie count, it's something.
It's ridiculous. He's a worker.
He's a
kind of
grinder.
like
Yeah.
now more. I feel like he was at least the first like real worker that was also crossing the A-list, because other A-list celebs would make a movie and he became A-list, maybe A-minus list, but he became A-list and would just keep producing. He was like the first that I remember that did that. Now it happens more often. Like The Rock is another one who's always doing all kinds of stuff and bringing in buku wuku for each of them.
So with Samuel L's clearly making bank, do you think he like is now careless? Do you think someone hands him a few quarters and he just tosses it in the bin? Or do you think he's hoarding that and being like, I worked hard for this?
If the bin is Bank of America, yes. I think he keeps it. I know what you're trying to do. Take us to the promised land.
Well, first of all, that's a European trash can reference, which you don't get on every podcast. So that's the bin. Gosh, Doogles, you sent me this article. It's amazing. I love every bit of this about Americans throwing away $68 million of coins per year. And it starts off like it just puts the hooks into me. There's a waste management facility in Pennsylvania where 7 years ago they were like, hey, we need to sort out some of this metal that comes in our trash heap and figure out what's in there. And since doing so, they're collecting $10 million worth of coins per year. Think of how that changed their P&L, I can only imagine.
It's one of those cases, too, where I would say you could get, this isn't how it came about for them, but you can see someone picking up a dime, or you pick up a dime yourself, and you go, what if I picked up all of the dimes?
Well, and so then maybe the article mentions this and I missed it, but if one waste management facility has collected, it's 10 million over 7 years, not per year. I misspoke. So the 68 million is obviously an estimate because not every waste management facility is doing this. It goes from that point to talking about the unit cost of producing and distributing coins. I just find this fascinating on all levels. So I'd heard the mystique around a penny costing more than a penny to produce, but it turns out a penny costs like 3 cents to produce. I mean, can we just kill these things already?
It is probably about that time. My son, a few weeks ago, found a dime. And he said, this is, Daddy, this is my lucky dime. I'm going to have this dime for the rest of my life. Guess how long that dime lasted?
Before he threw it in the trash?
No, before he just lost it.
A day.
2 hours. Which speaks to this piece. Because what it's saying is that with bills, you end up looking for bills. You're like, oh, I know I had 20 bucks. Where'd that 20 bucks go? You look through all your pockets. You lose a penny, you lose a dime. And you're just like, it's just gone, right? It might be in the trash and all good. It doesn't take any time, especially if you're 10, to lose a dime.
On the same lines, they talk about the amount of unclaimed money left at airports. That's going on $1 million a year.
I always leave my money at airports. It's kind of ridiculous. When I also think about the way that people feel about money right now and interest rates and inflation and all that stuff, like the feeling that money is becoming scarcer, And then you just leave it at the airport.
Well, it's a pain. And it is the, yes, you collect enough dimes. Right, this week I heard that, this was on Jeopardy, I believe. In 1938, when the March of Dimes campaign kicked off, they were trying to raise funds. And at that point, the March of Dimes actually meant, give me a dime. The White House was overwhelmed with the response and had so many dimes that they like didn't know what to do with them. Like the actual White House was overrun with dimes. But the value of a dime 100 years ago is drastically different than the value of the dime today. I guess to keep this short, we just got to knock some of these off, man. Maybe so a quarter costs 11 cents to make, a nickel costs 11 cents to make, and a dime only costs 5 cents to make. Let's kill pennies and nickels right away today and move on. Now, and get to the more important thing. Now, the more important thing, these trash collection facilities that actually take out all the metal, sort it, clean it, and recoup the $10 million over a 7-year period. What's even more valuable than that, Dougals, is they're finding lots of these Chuck E. Cheese coins. Think about that, man. I might start a facility just to get Chuck E. Cheese coins.
No, you won't. That's just silly. You're also not going to make an entire floor in your house out of pennies. There's some ridiculous things in this article.
There's a, and the floor looks rad. There's a table at one of our local restaurants that's entirely covered in pennies, simply as decoration. Again, because they're worth basically nothing.
This is fascinating stuff, I would say, in general. It's a lot of money. I would not have, if you'd asked me, I would not have guessed the $68 million. I would not have guessed the $10 million. I wouldn't, like, these are numbers that I wouldn't fully comprehend.
$10 million for a single facility seems like a lot, but I would have guessed there were tens of millions of dollars. This is effectively waste here. Waste in our monetary system, where the monetary system is not really serving the people, because no one desires to throw away money unless it's such a nuisance. We'll keep moving here, but check this article out. It's super fun. It also breaks down the fact that there's like 20 billion coins. Sorry, 17 billion coins in circulation. That was a 2015 number. Currently, there's maybe 12 billion coins in circulation. It just doesn't make sense. We're clearly doing this wrong.
All right. Shall we go on?
We shall move on. Dougals, I got a lot of feedback on my research recommendation last week.
To buy bleach?
To buy a boring chemical company in Belgium. Mm-hmm. And I know some people out there that are researching it, which is great. I got sent a research report. I will clarify, since I don't think I made this clear enough last episode, that I was giving trailing numbers, which are misconstrued when there's a spinoff that happens. I thought that was obvious, but regardless. But I found one this week, and this is like, it's going to torture me. So I didn't tell you about this because I wanted to get your immediate reaction on the podcast.
Yep. Okay.
And I think this is going to be like a meta at 80, Baba at current levels. Baba's back in the 60s. Reaction for you. Well, actually, it probably just doesn't fit your investor psyche. But have you ever heard people pitch like, oh, what's your perfect investment? And they go, oh, I'd love to hold a monopoly at discount prices. Like, have you heard people say that?
Yep. Right? Boring people.
Have you ever said anything along those lines?
No.
Okay. If you're an investor who has said like, oh, my perfect investment is to hold a monopoly at discount prices, there's a stock I feel like you have to research right now. Have to.
Is it the company that makes all those, the little baby hats?
What are the baby hats?
All the, if you ever see a newborn baby, they're all wearing the same hat.
It's a monopoly?
It has to be.
It's a white cloth hat. I think anyone could make
that. No, it's like tricolored with stripes.
Oh,
they're all wearing the same hat.
You just proved it's not a monopoly because my kids got these like white colored.
Yeah, but you went to the Deep Value Hospital.
I did not. That's a lie.
All right, continue. All right.
So there is effectively a monopoly, very consistent profits, almost does price fixing to make returns in the US that is trading at roughly 1985 prices right now.
So it's been around for a hot minute.
Yeah.
What do they make?
Well, they're a utility provider. Now here's the bad news, guys. This company is Hawaii Electric.
Hawaii
Electric might be liable for $2 to $5 billion worth of liabilities relating to the Maui fire.
I've checked them out, and I played this game before too. I played this game with PG&E.
Yes. So PG&E, I knew you'd go there. In my eyes, PG&E, I was intrigued with PG&E. I think Hawaii Electric is a completely different animal for a variety of reasons, but mostly because it's not in California.
I mean, yeah, that it does make a big difference.
So the market cap of Hawaii Electric, like, go back to its peak in early 2020, was $5.3 billion. The market cap today is roughly $1.2 billion. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is all about what the liabilities, you know, what the lawsuits break down.
Yeah.
Entirely about that. However, and so this is not an investment for everyone. It's probably not even an investment for 10% of people. But honestly, when else do you get an opportunity to pick up, like, they provide all the power for all the Hawaiian islands. Their infrastructure is in place. That the entity continues. Theoretically, they could get like sued to bankruptcy and some new entity could take over their infrastructure and provide power, theoretically. But what's probably much more likely is they'll pay some ridiculous fines, and 10 or 20 years from now, they'll operate in the same monopolistic environment back on their previous trend, which went from, you know, whatever. It went up consistently to $5 million was the true value of this utility. Yeah. You intrigued at all?
You just have to make a bet that prices will remain at least at some level, that because the volume is going to be the volume. I mean, there's going to be some population growth potentially, but the volume is going to be the volume. So you have to bet the price is going to stay the same. Generally speaking, do have some, I forgot about them, but I do have some intrigue with this one. And when I rode PG&E, I bought PG&E roughly like around $8 at one point and rode it up to about 13, something like that. And just, it is a different animal, I think, but I couldn't own it anymore. Like every PG&E story that came out made me feel so bad about myself. Yeah. So I couldn't. I do think that this one is probably different than that. But it is intriguing. I'm going to go back and look at them because I remember when they first started tanking, I was interested and I just forgot.
Well, it's funny because, you know, time horizons matter so much. And I find myself always being jealous of like Buffett when he got in with the, is it Santa Fe? He owns like the railroad purchase. You know, there's certain basic utility providers that just have to be around.
Yeah.
And effectively have to make money. But you look at like the railroad infrastructure, and it's crazy expensive because of that. People have wised up to it. Like, there's no deals to be had there. Most utility companies are super boring. And the monopoly, what I'm calling a monopoly, also limits your upside. Like, you can't, you know, it's not a 10x stock ever.
If there's a dividend component, that can be helpful in a case like this.
Can be very helpful. Well, so Hawaii Electric obviously cut their dividends.
Yeah, I mean, you have to.
I would expect dividends to come back once they get through the litigation mess. I honestly think this is a really interesting one. This is one where I feel like our brokerage houses are terrible because, honestly, if I buy this stock, I want to put a mini lock on it that says, and now I cannot sell this thing for 15 years. You know, like, it's just, it's exactly what you said. You'd watch the news and your emotions would take over about, oh no, this, that, or the other. The only reason you buy a stock like this, and again, it's a research recommendation, it's not a stock pick, is like, 10 years from now, things are going to look great. It'll be good for me.
Yeah. Speaking of lawsuits, I did take a look again at, just briefly, at Perion Networks, the one you made fun of me, PERI.
Yes. Yeah.
So the lawsuit claims, I need to go and read stuff again, but the lawsuit claims are, it's an investor lawsuit, and the investors are claiming that they weren't told enough information about the reasons why I did not first buy the stock. Like, it's like obvious stuff. They were saying things like, you didn't tell me how risky the Microsoft partnership was. I was like, Microsoft is 30% of their revenue. Like, how is it not going to be risky?
Yeah, you just read the 10K and you figure
that
out.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah.
You didn't tell us that the advertising business could have ups and downs. I was like, hold on. Like, this is just like the way business works. So I need to go back and look to see if I believe that there is something misleading, but it's that kind of a lawsuit at least from the get-go. And you still stay away, but I'm gonna take a gander.
Yeah, that's not for me. The official text came out like under investigation for fraud, whether that's actually true or not. And for me, that just means run away.
Yeah. Yeah. As it should. That's why you didn't buy that Luckin Coffee.
Uh-huh.
Luckin Coffee. Remember, it's the Chinese Starbucks. And this stock took off like wildfire. And then they said, but all your books are made up. So the stock went to basically zero and then came back. Because I guess they said, well, why don't we actually just run the company and see what happens? See what happens.
And then we have some free advertising from our fraud campaign. Yes, we could sell some coffee.
Our fraud campaign. Okay. Let's talk about the boom and bust business cycle and whether or not it's muerte.
Wait, are we talking about the Same as Ever book or the boom and bust business cycle or both?
Both.
Okay.
But let's do boom and bust first. There's a New York Times piece called "Is the Boom and Bust Cycle Dead?" And Skippy don't like this. He don't like this kind of talk. I don't like this kind of talk either. Let's be honest. This is the age old, this time is different type stuff is what's happening. I'll read this. A brigade of academic economists and prominent voices on Wall Street are asking if the unruly business cycle they learned in school and witnessed in practice has fundamentally morphed into a tamer beast. What they're saying is that historically, there were all these booms, all these busts. You had recessions coming out the wazizi, not any longer. That's just not the way the economy works anymore. People, busts at a time like this? No, thank you, it says. I love this quote. Financial reporters and market strategists often argue whether we are, quote unquote, early in cycle, mid-cycle, or late cycle, David Kelly, the chief global strategist at JP Morgan Asset Management, wrote in March. However, these perspectives are based on an outdated model of how the U.S. economy behaves. I'll let you speak on it for a sec.
I mean, come on, guys. The New York Times wrote this. It is true that recessions seem to be less frequent once we moved away from the gold standard and were allowed to print money. That is true. It is true that there's heavy manipulation of the economy. And it is also true that we're running massive deficits, which can stimulate and prolong things. Okay, but you missed the key quote. I love the quote you pulled, but there's a guy, I'm going to call him Rick Ryder, because I think that's how you say his last name.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be
satellite thesis.
I'm going to be mean to Rick for a second. First of all, it says Rick Ryder, who manages $3 trillion of assets at the investment firm BlackRock. Does anyone manage $3 trillion? Like, does that mean, honestly, does that mean he's picking? He's been like, put $1 trillion over there and $1 trillion over there. No, I think that means they have a bunch of index funds or like sub portfolios that maybe roll up to him. I don't think he manages anything. I'd be more impressed with someone that manages $50 million over someone that so-called manages $3 trillion. But that's my mini soapbox. Sorry, Rick. His quote here, but one point to keep in mind, he compares the U.S. economy to satellites. And then he says, but one point to keep in mind is that satellites don't land. And maybe that's a better analogy of the modern advanced economy. Are you serious, dude? Like, we're just now saying that we never have recessions anymore. We're just satellites floating into space. Let's stick with that analogy for a second. If that's what we are actually trying to do, and I don't believe it is, well, some bad actors, maybe. But what happens to a satellite when it runs out of fuel is it actually falls back and burns up in the atmosphere. Like, you can say that. You could say the bust is going to be much longer. And then the U.S. is going to completely dissolve as a financial superpower. You could say that. I just think the premise of this, maybe I'm taking it too seriously. Like, maybe this is just a journalist on deadline that had to put something down on paper.
Well, I don't think that the author, whose name I don't have in front of me, I don't think the author is agreeing with the takes. I think the author is saying that this is the take of some prominent folks. Is it true? I think that's the... the stance. I don't think the author is saying, I love these people and everything they say is gospel. I don't believe. And part of the rationale for these folks is they're saying that our economy has become so, as you mentioned, advanced and diversified. Mm-hmm. That what ends up happening is you have, like, during COVID, in-person services plummeted. E-commerce took off. And so it starts to balance out quite well. It mentions how the housing sector is typically accounted for 20% of the U.S. output. And we've had all this interest rate rise, which would say people ain't buying as many houses, but we aight. Like, so it's that's the core premise. I think it's hogwash, balderdash. That's what I think. And I think this is what gets us in trouble. And I love this. This is how it ends. This is how it ends. Because you're talking about Pretty Ricky is what they call him. But this is not Pretty Ricky. This is Nina Eichacker. I think that's how you pronounce her name. She's a professor of economics at the University of Rhode Island. And the article ends with this quote that she says, I am sometimes freaked out by how optimistic I feel about the state of things. Nina, baby.
I've tried to find the exact quote, but there's also an argument in here from these so-called experts that, like, the economy has morphed away from pro-cyclical goods like manufacturing and pro-cyclical industries to, like, more of a consumption and tech-based economy. So, like, yep. Oh, your Netflix subscription, you just pay the bill every month and it's way less cyclical than if you're buying iron ore. Come on, people. Maybe until it crashes and then everyone cancels their Netflix subscription. And all that, like, a consumption-based economy works until people stop consuming, and then the drawdown is way worse rather than, like, oh, we're following supply and demand curves in manufacturing. It just seems naive to say we're a satellite never coming back to Earth. I mean, come on, people.
So as transition, let's ask the question, is this time different or is it same as ever? Same as ever. Finally, I apologize to you. You told me last year, I don't think it was quite a year ago, but like last summer or something. It was a while ago. Same as ever. Read the book. Let's talk about
it. It came out in October. I was at the so-called book release party, another conference I was at. Got to hang out with Morgan. It's great. I think the book is predictably awesome. What did you think?
I enjoyed it. Full of all kinds of timeless wisdom, which is what Morgan does. I finally got to the book. And so we can talk about it now, 7 months later. So I apologize for that. However, let the past be the past. Let's be in the present.
Let's be in the present. Love it. I'm not mad. I'm here with you in the present. Yeah.
So one thing I'm going to raise that he brings up in here that we talked about on the pod 2 years ago, maybe, is the Minsky moment. I think that Minsky, in this vein, is so wise and it's so, like, simple to understand at the conceptual level, and Morgan talks about it. So the Minsky, what Minsky says, is he says that in times of peace, let's call it, in times of calm, that's when all the bad stuff ends up happening. Because if you take it in economic terms, what happens is people start seeing that things are up and to the right, everything's all good. And so then folks start going on credit. Because, as Morgan talks about, if something can only get better, like if stocks only rise, the only thing to do to maximize your returns is to get as much money as you possibly can and put it into stocks if they're only going up, if that's the psychology. And so then what happens is you take out credit, everyone's like blissful, dancing around, just like in Tokyo in the late 80s. Everyone's like up and to the right, popping champagne. And then that's when everything is most vulnerable. Minsky moment. That is the Minsky moment.
Wait, so if the New York Times just told me, if my boy Rick Ryder just told me that the U.S. economy is a satellite that's never coming back to Earth, that might mean that a crash is coming? Is that what you're telling me, Dougals?
He lied to you. He lied to you.
To that point, I'll stop throwing shade at the New York Times. To that point, what Morgan articulates so well is that, like, the crashes, the turbulence are the reason that the stock market performs so impressively. Like, it, and people say this sometimes that, like, the volatility of the stock market is the cost of admission. I think he does an incredible job articulating that, yes, if there's no crashes ever, then there's no perceived risk. And then people start to act stupid, and that creates risk. So, like, this is a yin and yang thing happening here.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's beautiful. He's such a good writer. I also enjoy that he talks about, it's kind of epic for me. He talks about how writing and storytelling is the powerful piece. Like, when a great writer is talking about how great writers are great, mm-hmm. without naming himself as a great writer, it's like, that's pretty, you pat yourself on the back via patting other people on the back. It's pretty wonderful. But he talks about it very solidly. I love it.
I was just going to say, I could talk about this for the next 30 minutes. So we can go as deep dive as you want. But if you're skipping, it's been 7 months. So let me touch on a few points. He starts the book with a take of a CEO that flies into Omaha to see Buffett right after the great financial crisis. And this guy's super scared. He never names the other person, but he's super scared. And he goes, is it different this time? Like, what should I be worried about? You know, sees a McDonald's on the corner and says, like, is McDonald's going to exist in 3 years? He's super freaked out. And Buffett effectively goes, like, hey, do you know what the best-selling gum was in 1942? I'm just making up numbers here. And he's like,
no, candy bar.
Is it candy bar?
Snickers. Yep.
And then, like, what was the best-selling soda in 1973? Coca-Cola. The point being that as much as things change, they often stay the same. And if you can find the pieces that really endure, this actually, in a way, might go back to a utility company in Hawaii, right? Or infrastructure in the US. Like, some things probably just have staying power, regardless of how bleak the world seems. And using that as an investment philosophy, which I think is intertwined in the book, can be a really, really solid approach.
Yes. And I'm gonna repeat part of what you just said and tack one more thing onto it. The whole premise of the book is that mostly what people look at is they say, what is changing? What's different? But if you instead say, what's always the case, then you can be ready for a multitude of scenarios. And it's about being prepared. It's not about predicting. That's the basic premise of the book that I think is so strong. I'll throw out a few of the chapters so that you can get so folks can get a sense. He talks about expectations versus reality. He talks about risk and how risk is the thing that you don't see. That's one of the titles. Like, if you prepare for everything, but the risk is always a thing that you don't yeah. see. He talks about how the best story wins. I talked about that a little bit. He talks about how people are so reliant on computation, but emotions are often actually what drives a lot of what's happening. And so you shouldn't be only on either side, but if you're only computing, does not compute is the theme of the chapter. If you're only computing, you're going to miss a lot of the story. It's a great read. And it's a short one. I love that fact, right? It doesn't go on for forever.
It's really quick. My take was, I mean, the conversation that I was able to have with Morgan, and I think I may have mentioned this on the podcast, but for me, I had my grandfather was like just super conservative and wise with money. It was just something he was inherently born with. And effectively, the way he had that stable base, as best I could tell, was he kind of always saved a little more than others did. You know, it was this preparedness you talk about. And then he would purchase assets rather than like material goods that quickly depreciate in value, right? And the theme I got throughout every chapter in the book with Morgan is like, you should probably be a little more conservative financially than you want to be. It should probably feel like you hold a little too much cash, because in the same as ever world, you know, in the turbulence that comes with our time, the risk that we cannot see, you'll almost never regret the ability to stay in the game, the ability to be a little more conservative than you want. Like, to me, that's the overarching theme. And I just think he's exactly right.
I'm going to go through the closing of the book. And then I want to talk a little bit about Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Okay.
So at the end of the book, and I'm going to go too far here, because there's so many questions that he lists out, and I'm going to try and name them all. And there's like 20 of them.
Please. This is
too much.
Man.
At the end of the book, He says, there are some questions that can help you to think through current situations and see what you might not be seeing. I thought these questions are so good. In the investment landscape, they're powerful. In life, they're powerful. I'm not going to have them verbatim, but I'll give like the spirit of each of the questions. Okay, so here we go. Who has the right answers, but you're ignoring them because they're not articulate?
Besides Dougals.
Besides Dougals. You could actually do besides Dougals after each of these. what do you believe that you would disagree with if you were born in a different country or a different generation?
I absolutely love that one. I'll try not to interrupt too much, but like, goodness, you can ask that question in so many ways, in so many situations, and you'll get a lot of uncomfortable answers.
Yes, yes, yes. What do I want to be true so much that I think it's true when it's clearly not?
For a while, that was Kohl's for me.
It's Kohl's. Yeah. What problem do I think only applies to other countries, industries, or careers? So that one's saying, oh, that's what happens in manufacturing. It gets back to the boom and bust where they're saying, you know, with like the goods versus the services economies. Like, yeah, that old boom and bust stuff was what happened in the goods economy. Now we have services economy. It's exactly the same.
The whole problem, all of America right now is being like, oh, the Italian stock market and the Chinese stock market.
Yes.
Oh, look at all those problems. We don't have any of those problems. Like, you go back to that crazy dude screaming about America's the only game in town and NVIDIA. And, you know, I mean, like, guys, we're not immune to any of these other problems. If you had to answer that one, Dougals, like kind of personally for you, what do you have an answer for that one?
I'm sure that I do. I haven't taken the time to think about it, and I really want to think about it, but I'm sure that I do. I'm sure that there are a number of things in the world of startups, for example, where I could say, yeah, but like with startups, you have to think about things exponentially. Right. I can think about things like that. I'm absolutely sure. Other countries, I know I do. Like, I know that there are things that I believe because America, even when I think about the idea, I guess the answer is yes. I do have one because now I'm talking. So when I think about the fact that there's so much anti-DEI narrative that exists in the US right now, and then I say, as an economy, in 20 years, we have to be reliant upon people that are Black, brown, and female consumers. Like, we have to be. And so then I was actually talking to a Forbes reporter a few weeks ago about this. I went, I'm super optimistic because America figures that out. Like, when we have to do a thing, we get a thing done. And what that ignores is, yeah, or we could just like not. Like, a lot of other countries also had to figure something out and they didn't. But I do believe. I believe in how we structured our government. I believe in our checks and balances. I feel like there's a lot of stuff I believe that could crash and burn. And I know that that is true that it could, but I believe.
I'll just say I share your optimism there. I think 20 years from now, we're going to figure a lot of this out.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. What do you think is true? Did you want me to ask that question of you? Like, did you want to answer that, by the way?
No.
Okay. All right. What do you think is true? But it's just good marketing. That's a real good one. What haven't I experienced firsthand that leaves me naive about how something works?
What haven't I experienced firsthand? Everything.
Yes, there's so much.
Have you ever had this? I mean, one of the great things about growing old, or at least getting into mid-age, is I'm at the point, I'll give a kind of personal example. I won't go into too many details, but I have like a health issue right now where I can't be nearly as active as I'd like to be. And I can remember vividly the right time in my teens and 20s where I would like see someone who's not active and have the most judgmental nonsense about that person. Yeah. Like, how dare that person live their life that way?
Yeah. Yes.
Because I had never been through it, right? Like, and the point to this question, if you go do whatever, you know, if you think people in this country are, let's just throw out lazy because it's an easy example. go live in that country in those conditions. I can guarantee your mindset changes. Whatever, 8 weeks in. Yeah. Guarantee.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. All right, next. What looks unsustainable, but is actually a new trend that's just not accepted yet? That's a tough one.
Yeah, and apologies here, because I'm trying to talk about these a little bit because I think it makes the question seem more important, right? If we just throw 20 questions out. But I don't think I have an answer for that one.
This is what occurs during like big shifts. Like you could say when the consumer internet first came out, I could see a number of folks that were like, yeah, but that can't last because no one's going to put their credit card online.
Let's take a slight detour here, if you don't mind. I swear it's related. Meta this week came out with Meta AI.
Ooh.
Now, we hate predictions and causality versus correlation and everything. I'm not claiming any of this is true, but there is a talk track going on after that release that says, well, what happened shortly thereafter? NVIDIA dropped. All the AI stocks fell off a cliff. OpenAI is rumored to be in a panic. The reason for this is Meta's AI was immediately rolled out to 3 billion users through their apps. And Meta's AI is also free. So when you look at something like Meta, that I think their current revenues are like $134 billion per year versus OpenAI, which I think their latest valuation, I forget how many billions it was, but it's a much smaller company. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
You could say that Zuck has decided to kill the potential competitors, even if that costs billions of dollars, because he's such a bigger fish in the pond right now that he just wants to commoditize the service. The other thing I don't think I mentioned, but hopefully people know, is Meta's AI is open source. So you have something that appears to be about as good as ChatGPT-4 and the other competitors in the space that you don't have to pay $20 for, that is not proprietary. Like, this is a big shift in the world, potentially.
Yeah, that absolutely is.
Morgan's point here.
It's like an interesting take on it, because you could say in this world, you could say that was the AI craze not sustainable, or is it sustainable and it's a new trend? I think it does raise the question.
So where I'm going with this, and it's just a debate, I don't know that I have a strong opinion here, is I think people were starting to say, oh, the AI trend is here to stay. It's game-changing and revolutionary. That's when NVIDIA's stock goes from $200 a share to $900 a share.
Yep.
And there's lots of hype around it, and it's super impressive. And there's tons of people that pay $20 a month, and database usage is up to power the compute power that drives AI. Like, for the last 2 years, the world has said AI is here and it's game changing. And then if you have one major player come out and say, you know what, here it is for free, and it's just as good as everything else, I think all of a sudden that may change the complete mindset around, why would I pay NVIDIA this much money when everyone has access to this?
Yeah.
Like, anyone could build an app with Meta's AI, I think. I haven't actually done it. I just think the narrative may have changed this week, but that's recency bias because we're talking about this this week.
We shall see. I think it's a good example. Oh, yeah, we shall see. Meta. I have lots of, we can go off on a separate talk track, I think, there, but it's a good point. All right. The next one is, who do I think is smart, but is just full of it? It's always good. It's always a good one to ask. Very straightforward.
I want you to throw out a name there.
I've got a couple. The next one, am I prepared to handle risks that I can't envision? That gets back to your grandfather cash point, at least in the financial sense.
I mean, I love this one. And it shouldn't only be financial too, right?
No.
We had, again, it related to wildfires, we had a power outage, preventative safety measures, 42 hours at our house. And we have young kids and everything else, right? That changed my perspective on if I'm prepared for the unexpected, because our heat didn't work, our hot water didn't work, We lost everything in our freezer and refrigerator. Like, it's honestly been like, I wasn't prepared for this. And I don't know what my actions will be, but I need to be more prepared for it in the future.
It's eye-opening how fragile, how seemingly robust but fragile my day-to-day life is. Like, the reliance that I have upon the internet, the reliance that I have upon electricity, I would just get 42 hours, I just give up.
I'm out of here.
What's the point? I'm just going to be a stinky, hungry mess walking around. All right, this next one is so up your wheelhouse. Which current views that I hold would change if I had different incentives?
All of them?
A lot of them.
Man, yeah, not to talk too much about this, but it's not all of them, but it's more than people think. Yep. And when people get to the ones that they think would not change, they need to go back to the previous question that asked about how their worldview would change if they grew up in a different country.
Yes. Yes. And it's not all financial, but there's an example that he gives in the book going back to the great financial crisis and people selling subprime loans. And an example that he gave was, there's a guy that was delivering pizzas and then got a job slinging subprime loans that he knew were going to crash and burn at some point. Like, it was just like, that's just known. And he's like, but do I leave this to go back to delivering pizzas? Like, it's kind of a, he's so incentivized, and you're incentivized by, especially like when you have a family, you got kids, like there's so many. And again, he's not just talking about financial incentives, but that's an easy one to understand.
Mm-hmm. And the pizza guy knew because he had street smarts. Like,
yeah,
it was pretty easy to put together if you were in the right spot in the market.
This is a question I love in my day-to-day career world. What am I ignoring today that will be shockingly obvious in the future?
That one's good.
Yeah. Usually I also, one of the things I think about there are, what are things that people do every day that take effort? Like, it doesn't have to be a lot of effort, but some effort. Like, as an example is, that always comes up for me, is dialing phone numbers. Like, the concept of the phone number will be ridiculous at some point in the future. The idea that I can't just say, contact Skippy, and then you will be contacted. But right in the back end, you can have unique identifiers. For like, Skippy will have a unique identifier somehow. But the idea that you have to put in 10 digits to, like, you have to remember and put in 10 digits. They're just things like that. They just go like, what do people do on a day-to-day basis that requires a strange amount of effort? All right. What very nearly happened that would have fundamentally changed my world if they had occurred? This is some butterfly effect type stuff. He gives an example. I'm gonna mess up the details of this, but folks will be able to get the spirit of it. He gives an example of the American Revolutionary War. And apparently, according to this story, the British like took New York City, won the battle there, and then wanted to head up north a little bit where like the rest of George Washington's troops were, but the wind was going in the wrong direction. And so they couldn't sail up north. And so they didn't. And what David McCullough, according to the book, what David McCullough said was, the revolution probably would have just been over. If the wind were going in a different direction, the United States of America would not have blossomed at that point in time. And the rest of history would have changed because of wind. And the point of this is to say, when we think about our own lives, there's so much credit that we end up giving to ourselves around why we are where we are. And he's saying, what very nearly could have knocked that off of its axis? That it's just because you walked through this door instead of that door, or you might have been late to a meeting. One of my cousins missed her train, because that's what Black people do. We miss our trains. Missed her train to head into New York City, and so was late to a meeting in the World Trade Center. And she was walking up the street when the plane hit, right? It's these things that you just never know. Small things, right, make a big difference.
Yep.
What is outside? This is very related to what I just said. What is outside my control that contributed to what I take credit for?
Everything. Not everything.
Yeah, but a lot of things.
I mean, yeah, you go to almost anyone's career arc. You can talk about Morgan's career arc. Morgan ended up, he had no desire to be a financial journalist. He ended up being a financial journalist because he was like couch sharing. He offered to couch share with this random person who ended up hiring people at the Monty Fool, like started his career. And the only reason Morgan took that job is he had nothing better to do. Like, we're reading his book because the East, the, in Same As Ever, he talks about a story where his life was hanging by a thread, and he made a, you know, a decision as simple as missing the train almost that saved him his life. Like, it's just also, luck just plays a way bigger role than people ever admit.
Yeah, it absolutely does. How do I know if I'm being patient, good trait, or stubborn, bad trait? Holes.
Yeah, I don't have an answer for that one.
That is a hard one.
That's the Buffett too tough pile. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. this is also one that you bring up often that I like. Who do I look up to that's secretly miserable?
So many people, the whole world.
Yes. He talks a good amount in the book about how people that just think differently. We've discussed this with Kanye, for example, like people that just think differently. They do, like, their whole worlds are not what you think that they are because their brains are wired in a certain way. He brings up Elon Musk. I wish I could remember exactly what he says, but he's like, the same person that figures out that they can build a reusable rocket is the same person that is 99.999% sure that we live in a simulation. That is what you get.
Do you know the story about, it's often told as a Mexican fisherman and a Harvard MBA. Have you ever heard this story?
I don't think so.
Oh,
that's quite a start to a story.
It's an awesome story. It's one of my favorites. It's often told. So I'm going to do a quick synopsis. Basically, there's a business consultant or whatever, MBA guy, and I have an MBA, so I can throw shade, down in Mexico on vacation, and he sees this guy hanging out on the beach effectively, and they start talking. He goes, like, what's your day-to-day look like? The guy says, I go fish for a few hours, then I sell the fish, that gets food for my family. In the afternoon I hang out with like my friends. At evening my wife and I like stroll into town and, you know, get some food or sit by the beach or whatever. And the MBA immediately is like, wait, you pay your bills with only fishing like 2 hours. Like, I got a great idea. What we can do is we can like build out a fleet. You can manage like 10 boats. We can get a commercial fishing operation. You can do this 20 years from now. Like, you are going to be a millionaire. And the guy's like, cool, this sounds good. And then they finally go, like, what will you do when you've made it, you know, when you're worth millions of dollars, like, what would you like to do? And he's like, well, I'd like to spend a little time on the ocean, spend some time with my friends, have a nice stroll with my wife, like hang out with my kids and grandkids. The irony here is he's already got it made, right? Now, I heard someone tell the story last month, and they told the story this way, Diggles, and I'm still blown away by it, but you can send it to check me. They told that story, and then they said, obviously the Harvard MBA isn't right, and obviously the Mexican fisherman isn't right. And I went, what? The fisherman's got it figured out, man. Like, do you need more than that? But some people think that there's still middle ground to be had. Sorry, I'm off on a tangent, but like, you got to figure out what you actually value in life.
Yes.
And if you already have it, the answer is not more money. That's the worst thing you can do. There's another guy like who has a take, and it's really hard to pinpoint the dollar figure, but he believes that above a certain income level or net worth level, life actually gets worse per dollar earned than better.
That's an interesting take. I'm sure that's probably different for everybody as well with that dollar figures. Yeah. Okay. Next question. What do I see as a hassle that's just an unavoidable cost of success? I think that's a good one. Here's another one. What crazy genius is just crazy? that's a pretty straightforward one. All right, there's only three more. You ready for it?
Yeah.
What strong belief do I hold that's most likely to change? And then he brings it home with what's always been true and what's the same as ever. There we are. We got through all of them.
Yeah, do you have answers for either of those last two?
I mean, this book is the same as ever. I mean, that's a thing. I think I've probably brought this quote up on the pod. Let me look it up to get it right, because I really love this Robert Frost quote. Most of the change we think we see in life is due to truths being in and out of favor. I love that quote. Like, absolutely love it. I bring it up at work a lot. People hate me for it, I think. Mm-hmm. Because there's so many times that someone will say, yeah, that's not true anymore. And I'm like, no, profit has always come when you take revenue and subtract your costs. Or I'll be like, I'll say, ignore what the market is saying. What would it take to build a great business? Like, well, you can't ignore the market. And I'm like, some things are just fundamental. Because if you pay attention to the market going back and forth, you go back 3 years ago and it was a fantastic idea to leverage yourself up to the, you know, to the moon and invest in whatever. It was a fantastic idea to do this stuff. But no, it wasn't. It wasn't a fantastic idea. It's never a fantastic idea. So that's why I love the quote.
The truth that most obviously goes in and out of favor to me is exactly what you're talking about. It's debt. How yeah. much leverage is acceptable? And my truth is usually none, like almost always none. But sometimes people will look at you crazy because of that. But it's what you're saying. It's still true. It's just completely out of favor.
Yeah. Thank you for letting me go through all those. It was a lot.
It's fun. I really like the book. I think it's a no-brainer read. Even if you don't really like finance stuff, there's so much great storytelling in there.
It's mostly not finance. He barely really talks good. About finance, but the lessons apply to finance, but he barely actually talks about finance in this one, I found. Mm-hmm.
Which is probably why it's so good.
All right. You got anything else?
One thing. This was tax week, or Ooh. Last week was tax week.
Ugh.
According to the National Taxpayers Union Foundation.
this Americans, is a real thing, people. This is a real thing.
Americans spent 6 billion hours on the compliance burden. The opportunity cost of the time burden was $280 per filer, and the out-of-pocket costs for tax preparation were 133 costs on average per filer. This is just stupid. I mean, we have made this so complex. You know, every tax season, the Donald Rumsfeld letter goes around. Have you seen this, Dougals?
I don't think so.
It's a one-pager that says, my wife and I filled out our taxes to the best of our ability. If it's wrong, I'm so sorry. I did my best. Basically, please let me know. And it's, at the time, I think he was acting, what, Secretary of State? And
defense, I think.
Yeah, defense. That's right. He, very smart, accomplished individual. He honestly would just write a letter every year that said, I have no clue if this is right. I'm doing my best. Please forgive me. Because he was such a high-ranking authority, he didn't want to be perceived as having tax fraud. Like, the fact that we can't just go, that they don't just send you a bill, say, pay this,
it's ridiculous. And because they have the answer. That's the thing. Here's my best example of they being the government. Have the answer. This was a few years ago, maybe 5 years ago. I'd done something wrong in my taxes in like 2015, something like that. And in 2019-ish, roughly, it was whatever was in the statute of limitations. So I'm getting the years wrong, but it was a few years later. The IRS sends me something that says, you messed this thing up in your taxes. Please correct it. Send it back. I was like, what the heck is this thing? Like, I don't know. Okay. So I, to the best of my abilities, per my good friend Donald, I sent it back in, corrected it, sent it back in. IRS sends me back something that's like, you got it wrong again. Please correct it and send it back. I sent it back in. Then the third time, so I got it wrong again. The third time, the IRS sends me something that's like, it's got all the notes on it. It like circles a number and says, please put this number in this box. And I just went, like, to your point, there's all this time that's being spent and they have the answer. Like, they know what it needs, but they just, because of the way our system's set up, they need me to put it in a box and like sign it. And they could have just sent me something at the beginning that just went, you owe us another $100 because of this. And I would have gone, okay, like we're good.
So I actually have a product innovation idea here. And I think the government should do it. It's so ridiculous. It would only work in America, but I think it would work. Let's say the average person owes $2,000. I don't know. Or let's do a percentage of your salary, right? Let's say the average person owes 2% of their salary at the end of the year, right? So you work through this, you pay your CPA, you do whatever, you end up with a number that's $1,500 or $2,500 or whatever. You fill that out, send it in. And then to your point, in some cases, 4 years later, they still tell you you did it wrong. If there was just like a random rule of thumb that said, listen, if you pay 5% of your salary, we promise not to audit you in the future. and people could just write a $5,000 check. You know how many people would pay more money, and in certain cases, significantly more money, to like know that it's over and done with. It's almost like insurance on a potential audit. So you'd fill out your paperwork, or TurboTax would tell you what you owe, and then you'd pay an extra X percent for insurance that they're not going to come back.
So it's basically the amount that everyone pays is wrong, but in aggregate, it comes out in the wash. there's no headache. Yeah. Oh, I like that innovation.
Yeah, they should do it. Anything in your fishbowl?
No, I'm good.
All right, that's it, guys. Listener mail, skippydougals.com. Please share the show with a friend.
skippydougals@gmail.com.
Well, yeah. All thanks for the show, skippydougals.com. Sorry.
There you go.
And we'll talk to you next week.
Bye.